Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Dozman. In the contemporary philosophical landscape, a variety of materialist ontologies have appeared, all wrestling with various political and philosophical questions in light of a post-God ontology. Entering into this discussion is my guest today, Adrian Johnston, to discuss the first volume of his three-volume Prolegomena to Any Future Materialism, an attempt to develop a systematic and thoroughly atheistic material ontology of the subject. The first volume, subtitled The Outcome of Contemporary French Philosophy, published in 2013, looks at three recent French theorists, Jacques Lacan, Alain Badiou, and Quentin Mielessoux, arguing that all three ultimately fail to maintain a consistent atheism, regularly relying on various supramaterial elements to hold their systems together. In doing so, the book attempts to clear the ground for a consistently materialist ontology to be pursued in the latter two volumes. Adrian Johnston is Chair and Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of New Mexico and a faculty member at the Emory Psychoanalytic Institute. He is the author of close to a dozen books, including, among others, Time Driven, Metapsychology and the Splitting of the Drive, and Adventures in Transcendental Materialism, Dialogues with Contemporary Thinkers. He is also a co-editor of Northwestern University Press's book series Diaresis, of which this trilogy is a contribution. So, Adrian Johnston, welcome back to the New Books Network.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be back. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you again, Stephen.
All right. So as always, we like to always introduce our guests or have them introduce themselves. So could you maybe tell us a bit about what your main research interests are and how this fits into that?
I can begin by saying that I take my philosophical inspiration from three orientations: German idealism, Marxism, and psychoanalysis, and that using the resources from these particular intellectual traditions, I attempt to intervene in a number of areas of both perennial and contemporary concern, issues in ontology and metaphysics, philosophy of science, philosophy of religion, and of course, contemporary socio-political and cultural matters. So this is, the sort of basic, framework that that governs what I do in terms of ongoing research, and that I anticipate in the foreseeable future continuing to guide my thinking and writing.
Wonderful. So to kind of start things off, I'd like to quote you from this book at length a bit. You write, quote, "Lacan predicts that religion will triumph not in spite of the thrusts and encroachments of modernizing science and technology, but precisely because of this relentless collective march forward. To be more exact, the Lacanian prophecy apropos this issue is that the more techno-scientific development intensifies and expands the meaninglessness of desacralization and disenchantment, all the more to a parallel proportional degree will people turn to authorities appearing to guarantee the meaningfulness of life and the universe. The growing desert of the real is a harsh terrain within which subjects are prone to lapse into religious deliriums and hallucinations. Today's societies are living out the disastrous consequences of this toxic, potent intermixing of religion and science, stuck between capitalist techno-manipulation and its irrationalist discontents, seesawing between the twin big others of the nature of scientism and the god of superstition within the constraining global space of neoliberal economy, humanity is stranded in the waking nightmare of a disgustingly reactionary and horrifically hopeless period of history. So you have said a lot in this passage, but I think it gives a really valuable cultural background to your work, or political background. So can you unpack your understanding of our current political and economic moment and how this series is intended not just as a set of theoretical developments, but as an intervention in a larger set of issues we're facing?
Yes. And what I want to do is to unpack this quotation in relation to a project I am currently in the process of finishing. So assuming that the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic does not cancel my kids' summer camps, by the end of this summer, I should have finished a new book tentatively entitled Infinite Greed, Money, Marxism, Psychoanalysis, that, you know, as the subtitle makes clear, involves combining in particular Marxism and psychoanalysis. And one thing that struck me when I reread this quotation from the 2013 first volume of the Prolegomena is that there's a real continuity here between a central portion of my new book and this book that we're discussing that was published a few years ago. And what I argue in this key chapter of this new book is that basically we are in a situation both in terms of issues having to do with science and nature, as well as with the economy, where, as I put it in this current project, basically we are religious where we believe ourselves to be secular and secular where we believe ourselves to be religious. And in terms of nature and the focus on, science and scientism in the first volume of the Prolegomena, well, this involves pointing out, and I'm not unique in observing this, that oftentimes, people who claim to be hard-nosed, scientific, materialists, naturalists, etc., their vision of nature, which itself is not a strictly scientific or experimentally confirmed hypothesis, but is rather a kind of metaphysical vision of nature, that it really is just a not very modified, sublimation or permutation of something that really is religious and more specifically monotheistic, and that all that they've really done is just rename God nature, that they transfer attributes traditionally assigned to the divinity of monotheism to what they call nature. And so, you have nature as omniscient, omnipotent, all controlling, all embracing, etc., and that various supposed atheistic materialists, when they talk about nature, you could easily, if you just focused on how they characterize it, you could see it as just again a renamed version of the god of traditional monotheism. And so, there we think we're secular or atheistic, but in fact, we remain very much in the thrall of features of monotheism and its theology. And that, in this new project, I look at this not only in relation to how we conceive of nature and how we think about it scientifically or pseudoscientifically, I also look at the economy, and the way that we relate to the economy, as Marx himself, I think, already did a lot to reveal, the way in capitalism that we relate to the economy, we treat it very much like God. That the invisible hand of the market is not much different than the divine appendage that pulls our strings. Interestingly, at the level of religion, I've talked a bit about where we are actually still religious, you know, or theological, where we think we're secular atheistic. But when you also look at what's happened with religion, you know, it's now become much more a matter of this worldly sectarian identity politics, that, you know, much of it is really a matter of religion functioning as a point of identification or as a kind of, you know, emblem of, you know, this is our group, you know, whether it's, we think of it as the Christian West or what have you, that, you know, we now tend to, in terms of religion, be much more concerned, it seems, in terms of our contemporary investment in it with, you know, again, very this worldly cultural identitarianism. And so we're in a circumstance where, you know, we still remain faithful in a certain way to the old, you know, monotheistic theological framework, but we do so at the level of what we take to be our secular atheistic conceptions of nature and the economy. And when it comes to explicit religion, much of that has lost its, you know, supernaturalistic or otherworldly aspects and has become much more a matter of, you know, this worldly us versus them, identitarian clash of civilizations type politics. And so it's a very peculiar circumstance.
So to kind of dive into the text itself and to develop some things you were just alluding to, you start with a discussion of Lacanian materialism and its relation to religion. In outlining a properly Lacanian materialism, you argue that atheism doesn't necessarily entail materialism, at least according to the Lacanian understanding. Or using the language of philosophical logic, we might say that atheism is necessary but not sufficient for materialism. So can you unpack the problem here and explain what a true or consistent Lacanian materialism would be?
Yes, and there's certain things about Lacan's relationship to materialism that I am confident will come up later with some of the subsequent questions. But for now, I can begin by saying that in my view, it's actually, in terms of the relationship between materialism and atheism, what I would say is that materialism is a necessary but not sufficient condition for atheism. And what I mean by this is closely connected to some of what I was saying a moment ago in response to the first question. And, you know, if you look at, for instance, the history of materialist thought, you know, for example, take the 18th century French materialists, you know, who were involved in this, you know, Enlightenment struggle against clerical authority, that, you know, when you take figures like, you know, D'Holbach, La Mettrie, Diderot, etc., that what you see is that, all right, for them, atheism involves insisting that it is nature, not God, you know, that is responsible for all of reality. But even though this is this renaming of you know, the you know, the governing ultimate, you know, horizon of reality, the renaming of it nature rather than God, certainly is not without a lot of significance. And especially, of course, these were thinkers who were primarily concerned with fighting out a political and ideological struggle against a religion that was shoring up a political order that they were seeking to assault. What they do in moving from God to what they call nature is that, again, they just take the attributes of the old God and reassign them to nature. And although this is, you know, a first step in the direction of atheism, on my view, though, it's only a first step, and it's insufficient precisely because nature is now, you know, basically just an altered version of the religious God. And for me, there's a subsequent step to be taken beyond this, which is to, and this is what I'm trying to carry out in a number of places, including in this first volume of the Prolegomena, is moving from what I call strong nature, and that is a vision of nature with a capital N as basically akin to the old God, and showing that, you know, nature itself is not this unified totality, this harmonious whole, this locus of central authority that, you know, runs the show, this guarantor of at least consistent order and regularity, if not also meaning, you know, that the additional step of de-theologizing nature involves turning it from this strong nature that is very much modeled on the old God, and instead looking at it as this fragmented multitude, this non-unified, field of disparate entities and events that don't all hang together in this grand scheme or cosmic order. And so this would be to, you know, in a way, it's like the Hegelian negation of the negation. You have the first negation of renaming God nature, and then you have to carry out the second negation of getting rid of the features of the old God that have been smuggled into the old version of nature. And carrying out the second step, the negation of the negation, you could say is what I'm really, you know, attempting to carry out using a number of resources, including, figures like Lacan, Badiou, and Mayasil.
So jumping off of that, you find recent developments in the neurosciences actually validate this sort of materialism of incompleteness that you're aiming for, particularly with reference to neuroplasticity, which you've developed philosophically elsewhere, especially alongside Catherine Malibu. Can you give us a quick primer on neuroplasticity and how does it function to validate the sort of theoretical materialism you're trying to get at?
Yes. And here is where we're zooming in from nature in general to human nature specifically. And of course, you know, when one uses a phrase like human nature, you know, what we often think of is that, well, at the core of who and what we are, as the animals or organisms, you know, that we are, Homo sapiens, is ultimately, you know, determined or at least rests upon a bedrock of natural foundation where, you know, thanks to, say, evolution, genetics, et cetera, we have this programming, you know, our DNA, et cetera, that, you know, ultimately is determinative of who and what we are. And that this is fixed in place by the forces of nature at a broader level in terms of things like, you know, natural history qua evolution, et cetera. And so, you know, when we talk about human nature, we tend to think of something fixed, firm, immutable, this unalterable core that, you know, is just part of us from birth. And one of the things that, you know, neuroplasticity, among other relatively recent findings in the life sciences, indicates is that this picture of even the natural component of ourselves, however we conceive of that, is scientifically speaking untenable. What neuroplasticity says is that the configuration of our central nervous system, and of course the brain, you know, would seem to be a good candidate for that part of our biology that is the seat of our subjectivity, that the brain is, as one could put it, that it is pre-programmed to be reprogrammed or hardwired to be rewired. And, you know, put in terms of the simple nature-nurture distinction, it's what neuroscience indicates is that we are by nature inclined to the dominance of nurture over nature, or our first nature is itself structured so as to be open to taking on these features of a second nature that is acquired rather than innate. And so from within biology itself, and specifically here neuroscience, we have a natural scientific discipline delineate within its own disciplinary confines these openings where it would say biology alone is insufficient for explaining who and what we are. And it's one thing to say biology is insufficient for explaining who and what we are from an extra scientific or even anti-scientific standpoint versus being able to say it on the basis of the findings of the natural sciences themselves. And, you know, for me, one of the key significances of neuroplasticity, also epigenetics, which emphasizes just how much environment and experience govern the translation of our genotype into phenotypic features, that these are points within science and specifically within the life sciences where we have a kind of intra-scientific immanent critique that indicates that science itself shows that we should not be scientistic reductionists and try and look for all of the answers, you know, in science as the ultimate buck stops here, you know, authority on determining, you know, who and what we are as human beings and subjects.
So moving along, in chapter two, you turn to the question of how to integrate or synthesize biology with psychoanalysis and turn to a debate that goes back quite some time. On the one hand, psychoanalysis has a long history of trying to purge itself of Freud's commitment to biology, although the danger you see is that it ends up becoming too abstract, trying to resolve certain issues with a sort of borderline mystical ontology of subjectivity. So can you give us a sense of this debate and explain how it is you try and move between these two options with a sort of bio-Lacanianism?
Yes. And here, I mean, one has to bear in mind that both Freud himself, as well as many non-Lacanian analysts and analytic orientations, do not share Lacanianism's pronounced anti-naturalism and allergy to biology, especially. Of course, yes, Freud was medically trained, was, you know, very steeped in what was then, you know, cutting edge neuroscience, had high hopes for future syntheses of psychoanalysis with the life sciences. And a lot of non-Lacanian analytic types, you know, have indeed, you know, continued to try and work at those intersections. And in fact, you know, there's a flourishing branch of psychoanalysis called neuropsychoanalysis, but it is remarkably free of Lacanianism, that it's really non-Lacanian psychoanalytic orientations that have been involved in establishing and developing the field of neuropsychoanalysis. And, you know, I think that there's been this there are a few exceptions, but it's generally been a matter of Lacanians refusing to engage with this and thinking that neuropsychoanalysis is this horrible, you know, mistake that involves trying to take what psychoanalysis is concerned with and collapse it into the, you know, explanatory and therapeutic jurisdiction of the neurodisciplines. And so part of what I'm trying to do is, you know, in tandem with a few outliers like myself, try to both overcome what I think is Lacan's not very convincing arguments against naturalism, and moreover also arguments, especially by some of his followers, and, you know, in so doing, open up the possibility for a rapprochement between Lacanianism's very sophisticated metapsychological framework and the resources offered by the neurosciences. And of course, you know, in the background lurks, for me, you know, a rather, you know, straightforward intuition, which is that when you're talking about human beings and especially about minded human subjects, that the idea that, you know, the study of the brain has no significance or implications for this is ridiculous. That, you know, ultimately there's just this brute simple sense of, if you can't square your theory of minded subjectivity with what, you know, our best neuroscience says, that you're in trouble. And I think that, you know, the arguments for that Lacanians have for not having to face up to that aren't particularly convincing.
In the final chapter on Lacan, you look at his thoughts on prehistory, primarily with a focus on our inability to get to it. For the most part, he leans in this respect to a sort of Heideggerian or Kantian weak epistemology, where we're placed within a prison house of language, to borrow Frederick Jameson's phrase. Can you unpack what prehistory is and what it means for Lacan to put it off limits epistemologically?
Yes. And here, you know, we could distinguish between two senses of prehistory. First, there would be prehistory in the sense of human history prior to language and to with language recorded history. And this is, you know, an area that, you know, a number of different disciplines are interested in studying. And then over and above that, of course, there is the idea of a natural history, which long predates human history, whether recorded or not. So we have these two senses of prehistory, but they have in common that both are prior to the advent of, among other things, language, and prior to, you know, the human sociocultural history in which, you know, things get recorded, et cetera. And Lacan, particularly during the 1950s, when his engagement with structuralism is indebted to ultimately Saussure's linguistics is at its height. You know, Lacan wants to say, I mean, and you rightly use Jameson's phrase, the prison house of language. You know, Lacan wants to say that, you know, whatever is, you know, beyond, behind, or beneath language, whatever comes before it, what is prior to it, about that, we can know or say nothing, or if we try to do so, we're just going to end up confabulating or telling, you know, fictional just so stories. You know, I think that, and Lacan argues this both in, to use a Freudian distinction, both at the ontogenetic and phylogenetic levels. So at the ontogenetic level, you know, Lacan would say that, you know, in terms of our own life histories, you know, whatever came before we acquired language, or before, as Lacan might prefer to say it, language acquired us, you know, whatever lies in our early childhood experience prior to language acquisition, that's unknowable for us. That, you know, becomes epistemologically and also for Lacan, clinically off limits. And then on the phylogenetic level, in terms of the history of the human species, you know, whatever comes before recorded history, you know, in the sense humanity's, you know, pre-verbal childhood, that too is epistemologically out of bounds. And for Lacan, among other things, we cannot know and cannot, you know, tell a convincing story that could count as knowledge. We cannot say anything about the origins of language. And this leads Lacan to, I mean, it's really shocking, but there's a moment in his teaching, it's specifically in his fourth seminar, there's a session of it in which Lacan has approving recourse to the Christian notion of the Holy Spirit. You know, he says that we essentially have to consider the advent of language like the descent of the Holy Spirit upon us. And so we have this, you know, sort of inexplicable ex nihilo, you know, descending out of the skies or popping up out of nowhere, miraculous moment. And then after that, we're fully, you know, human qua, you know, speaking subjects, et cetera. And, you know, I find that the sort of, you know, idealism, and even religiosity, and for, that is, I think, Lacan being consequent. But I think it's the signal that he took a misstep along the way. And so, yeah, I want to, and moreover, of course, you then also would have to write off a whole series of different disciplines, you know, including a number, you know, branches of the life sciences, anthropology, archaeology, et cetera, that I think are reveal quite the contrary, that we can, through different, you know, approaches, that we can come to know quite a lot about prehistory, both as human history prior to recorded history, as well as, of course, natural history prior to the advent of the human species itself.
To end with your section on Lacan, you turn to Daniel Lord-Smale's theory of deep history, and you follow him and develop a critique of Lacan that his view of temporality is still tinged with a certain religious residue and is insufficient both for being materialist enough as well as failing to keep up with recent developments in evolutionary biology. So can you unpack what's going on in this final section?
Yes. So this is very closely related to what we were just talking about with regard to the previous question. In Daniel Lord-Smale's book, on the topic of deep history, you know, I found to be a perfect resource for mounting some of these criticisms of Lacan's condemnation of us to the prison house of language, and linking that up with, you know, these bigger issues having to do with religiosity that are of central concern to me in the book as a whole. And Smale is pushing back against, you know, various approaches to human history, which indeed want to limit us to talking about human history only once we have the beginnings of recorded history in terms of, you know, human beings leaving, you know, linguistic symbolic records. And what Smale means by deep history here would be, you know, the notion that, well, human history goes much further back than, you know, any of the versions of, you know, where we mark the beginning of recorded history. And Smale points out that, you know, curiously enough, most of the ways of dating the beginning of recorded history by supposedly secular or atheistic historians, you know, tends to correspond with things like the biblical sense of, you know, the age of the earth and with it humanity, et cetera. And so it's as though the temporal scheme of biblical history gets disguised in the secular mode of, well, we don't really begin as human beings proper until we have the start of recorded history. And Smale shows again how, you know, we are in this way, we continue to be religious even when we think we are, you know, operating in a purely secular fashion. And along with this, I agree with Smale that, you know, if you have this sense of, you know, human history only begins with recorded history, and along with that, you say, well, we can't know anything about history prior to its being recorded, well, then you leave the very genesis of recording itself, right? The advent of language and everything it brings with it, inexplicable. And it easily, you know, functions as a disguised version, or even with Lacan's reference to the Holy Spirit, it becomes even overtly a matter of, well, one fine day, this sudden miracle happened and language appeared, poof, you know, ex nihilo, and then history really began. And whether implicitly or explicitly, you know, this is a kind of obscurantist, mystical, you know, even just really religious narrative that both Smale and I, you know, Smale is concerned, of course, with intervening in disciplines, dealing with human history. And I, of course, am applying this in terms of a critique to Lacan. But Smale and I, are very much on the same page here. And, you know, I even I corresponded with him about his book, and then he and I had a chance to, you know, sit down together here in Albuquerque. And he was shocked that Lacan allowed himself to say things like, you know, the genesis of language is the advent of the Holy Spirit in the world, and found, you know, and, you know, he and I really found that we were on the same page here.
Yeah, that's a really good way to close that off. So you next turn to Alain Badiou, who's in a rather peculiar position, simultaneously claiming allegiance to mathematics in Platonism, while also asserting himself as a materialist. So I think maybe the key way to work our way into this aspect of his thought would be his assertion about the non-existence of nature, nature being understood with a very peculiar sense here. So can you maybe explain what he means by this to start us off?
Yes, and perhaps I can start with, you know, Badiou's recourse to Plato, which, you know, especially in the past decade has been a very pronounced feature of a lot of his work, and, you know, how that already marks a big difference between myself and him. So, you know, and really thanks to Badiou, it's become quite fashionable amongst a number of my fellow travelers in terms of people interested in contemporary metaphysics in the continental tradition, you know, with debts to orientations like German idealism, Marxism, and psychoanalysis. You know, that Badiou, and then along with him, a number of others, claim that, you know, what we need to do is to develop a combination of Platonism and materialism, and that moreover we can read Plato as not only as a materialist by, for instance, trying to reread Plato's idea about how the forms participate, you know, in the visible world, etc., you know, but also, you know, Badiou even wants to lay claim to him, you know, as a sort of proto-communist, you know, thanks to how Plato talks about the community of guardians in the Republic. And to cut a long story short, I am much more of a spontaneous Aristotelian than a Platonist. And, you know, Badiou has nothing but antipathy for Aristotle. But, you know, following, for instance, you know, figures like Hegel himself, I think that, you know, Aristotle's metaphysics is, you know, obviously much closer to, and I think rightly is regarded as, you know, much more congenial to any kind of materialist approach than Plato, the, you know, really the one of the founding fathers of metaphysical realism, and along with it, a kind of anti-materialist idealism. And so I'm unconvinced by these efforts to recast Plato as some peculiar sort of materialist and radical leftist. But that aside, when Badiou turns his attention to the topic of nature, and, you know, he takes us up in a number of places, most importantly in his 1988 magnum opus, Being an Event, he says one version of nature does not exist. And then there's another version of nature that he says this is the correct conception based on my, Badiou's ontology. The version that he denies, and here I am somewhat sympathetic to him. So, you know, Badiou wants to develop this ontology of what he calls pure multiplicity. And his recourse to mathematics, especially set theory, is centrally involved here. But Badiou wants to say that there are no fundamental unities at either a macro or a micro level. At the fundamental, in terms of fundamental ontology, that that being at both the largest and smallest levels is just a series of proliferating multiplicities without end, and so you have this idea of, with Badiou, a oneless ontology, you know, that is that purges any appeal to, you know, to, you know, grounding or all encompassing unities, you know, gets rid of them. And here, this idea of banishing the one, of exorcising the specters of unity, totality, wholeness, etc. I mean, that's something I actually take inspiration from, and, you know, likewise seek to develop in my own way, but without making this depend upon, you know, the abstract formalism of pure mathematics. But where I disagree with Badiou here is that he says, all right, well, with nature, and, you know, I should back up a moment. I should say, I agree with him that nature, in terms of this idea of an all-encompassing unity, you know, a fundamental wholeness or totality that is internally, you know, harmonious and homogeneous, I share with him a rejection of that. But then Badiou says, you know, even though nature is not this one-all or this whole or totality, it nonetheless is this domain of, you know, utterly lawful regularity, that nature is this, you know, in his set theoretic ontology, nature is this set of structures and dynamics that are consistent with themselves and that involve a kind of smooth running of a predictable, you know, lawful business as usual. And it's weird. It's almost as though you get a vision of nature here, which is pre-modern, where, you know, it's like, you know, the ancient and medieval conceptions of nature as that eternally recurring order of regular cycles, such as the changing of the seasons. And, you know, that sense that nature is nothing but lawful regularity and cohesive, self-consistent order, despite Badiou's detotalization of it. You know, that I think that picture of nature is not really defensible. And that, you know, for me, you know, nature is a lot less lawful, regular, etc., than Badiou depicts it as being. And that, moreover, it contains internal differentiations within itself, such as various layers of emergence, that, you know, involve a diversity and heterogeneity of forms of regularity or structure that Badiou's way of talking about nature doesn't have a place for and wouldn't be able to capture.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In his 2006 book, Logics of Worlds, Badu draws our attention not just to the materialism-idealism debate, but points to a rift within materialism itself. You write, quote, "On the one hand, there is a materialism, democratic materialism, wholly compatible and thoroughly complicit with the socioeconomic order of late capitalism. On the other hand, there is another materialism, a materialist dialectic, advocated for by Badu as an assault on the hegemony of late capitalist ideology and everything that goes along with it," end quote. So can you unpack these two materialist approaches and how they feed either into or against our current socio-political climate?
Yes, and this is a place in Badiou that elicits a lot of sympathy from me. I mean, and again, with all three of these figures in this book, Lacan, Badiou, Mayassu, this book in part is me settling accounts with these influences on my own work. Drawing up a balance sheet of, places where I agree with them and places where I profoundly disagree. But this is one of those points that, involves me being in substantial agreement with Badiou. And what Badiou means by this distinction, we can start with, his phrase democratic materialism. And what he's seeking to capture with this is a set of worldviews, and we could even say of ideologies, that are, we would readily recognize as, pervasive forms of relativism, culturalism, social constructivism, where, the basic perspective is that, human reality is this diverse array of different linguistic and cultural universes. And all we have are these, various and sundry communities, life worlds, different fields of meaning. And they're, perhaps sometimes they might be compatible, sometimes they might be incompatible. But all there is this diversity, and there is no possibility, since this is all there is, there's no possibility for anyone to appeal to the true, the universal, the eternal, etc. Everything is relative. Everything is just a matter of context and of incommensurable times, places, and perspectives, right? So it's this family of perspectives, this set of worldviews or ideologies that Badiou labels democratic materialism. What he contrasts with this is what he calls materialist dialectics, which, of course, the very phrase itself is obviously indebted to the Marxist tradition. But instead of a Marxism that participates in this relativism by saying everything is just simply reducible to history and is always historically localized, and really that's not Marx's position either, but Badiou is interested in how do you develop a materialism that is a materialism, but that allows you to account for things that we traditionally associate with idealism, namely, strong senses of truth, universality, eternity, infinity, etc. And so this idea of, how could we account for, as if you're, for instance, indebted to the Marxist tradition, how, as a historical materialist, can you account for the history imminent genesis of things which, once they arise in history, thereafter cease to be merely historical or localizable within particular, social, et cetera, contexts? A simple example suffices here. I mean, on the one hand, it's easy to observe that the foundations of arithmetic and geometry as abstract mathematical disciplines are Those foundations are laid in the ancient Greek world. And that, of course, is a particular historical context, a specific, social, cultural, et cetera, life world. But of course, we'll readily recognize that even though we can trace the origins of anything whatsoever, including mathematics, to a specific time and place, that those disciplines aren't just Greek, and can't just be reduced to their origins, and that they, take on a certain, trans-historical, one might say eternal validity thereafter. And Badiou, like me, is interested in the possibility that this sort of thing happens in, not just in isolated cases like mathematics, but in various domains of human history, you have moments where something emerges, which once it comes on the scene, can't just be treated as one fleeting historical phenomenon among others. And so there he and I are both after the same thing. But my critique of him is that he, in trying to have both of these things, to be a materialist on the one hand, and on the other hand, be able to appeal to categories like truth, universality, infinity, eternity, etc., that his way of trying to hold on to both of these doesn't allow him to really, keep a firm grip on the materialism side of the equation.
A problem you identify with Badiou is his criticism of biology and neuroscience, and you even quote him in an interview comparing neuroscience to phrenology at one point. This, you argue, involves a fundamental misunderstanding of both what neuroscience is and how it can be used to inform and develop philosophy, as well as related political theories. Can you unpack the core elements of his criticism here, as well as the misunderstanding reflected?
Yes. So, here the Badiou's appeal to phrenology, is really quite telling. And in fact, of course, Hegel famously in the 1807 Phenomenology of Spirit directly critiques the phrenology of Franz Josef Gall. For instance, there are, relatively recent bits of Hegel scholarship which try and take Hegel's critique of phrenology and argue that this is just as applicable to contemporary neuroscience, and that therefore contemporary neuroscience is not really advanced beyond what we know was an intellectually bankrupt endeavor, namely phrenology. And Badiou, makes the same claim here, albeit without, I think, the reference to Hegel. But anyhow, I think that this is, utterly unfair and reflects a profound lack of understanding of the neurosciences. So, what was phrenology in essence? Well, it was an effort to localize features of persons in relation to bumps on the skull, and bumps on the skull taken as indicating how the underlying brain beneath the skull was configured. And so phrenology was an early attempt at what we would call neuroanatomical localization, right? It was an attempt to map one-to-one correspondences between, for example, personality traits and the configuration of the brain as supposedly revealed by the contours of the skull. And of course, not only, do we know that it was problematic to try and use the contours of the skull to infer things about the anatomy of the brain in particular persons, there's also and this is what already Hegel goes after, and that, Badiou is dismissing when he dismisses neuroscience as still phrenological. It's really the program of neuroanatomical localization, right? And the idea that, either we can map one-to-one correspondences between our subjectivity and our brains in specific regions of our brain, or that doing so is informative, tells us anything, actually revealing, etc. And so Badiou is essentially saying, when he compares contemporary neuroscience to phrenology, that what neuroscience boils down to is nothing more than this either a vain or uninformative program of localizing all of the features of ourselves in specific regions and subregions of the brain. And although there, is a certain amount of work that's done in neuroscience in terms of localization, that is hardly representative of the entire procedure of those disciplines or even the essence of them. And that, of course, to begin with, right? We neuroscientists, emphasize that there isn't this neat one-to-one pairing of features of ourselves and regions of the brain, that in fact, there's a high degree of distribution of, different functions and how those functions manifest between multiple parts of the brain. Furthermore, with, for instance, epigenetics and neuroplasticity, there's also the awareness that, well, it's not as though there's any explanatory finality to saying this part of the brain is giving rise to this feature of our mindedness or subjectivity, because it may very well be that in terms of the causal history of why that part of the brain is doing this, we're going to have these plastic synaptic networks having been shaped and reshaped by things like environmental experience, the person's relationship to their natural and social environment, et cetera, that is going to be, that is going to have configured and be reflected in how that neural circuitry is working. So there's not a sense that localization is any kind of ultimate explanatory, buck stops here finality. In addition, I think that, there's this profound, appreciation, amongst neuroscientists that, the brain itself is not only a matter of regions and subregions that either individually or cooperating through relationships of distribution are generating features of our subjectivity, but there's a paradigm advanced by some people working in these fields of what is called the kludge model of the brain. And a kludge is, in engineering terms, a kind of improvised, slapped together, basically, you might say, held together with duct tape, et cetera, contraption to solve a problem. But it's very improvised, haphazard. And you might think of it as almost like, a kind of MacGyver model, right? Where, okay, I've got some old chewed bubble gum, a book of matches, a paperclip, and somehow I'm going to put this together to, create this device that will get us out of a jam. You look at the brain, what, the life sciences, now are indicating is that, well, it's the product of this haphazard evolutionary history. And it's when we examine our brain, what we see is that there are all these different components and subcomponents that have been slapped together under the pressures of a contingent haphazard evolutionary history. And that instead of all of these things cooperating to generate our mindedness and subjectivity, doing so as a matter of a distribution of labor between, very well organized, localities and regions of the central nervous system, that part of what makes us who we are is the fact that our brains are basically this awkward marriage of these components that don't work very well together. And that you have, for instance, an evolutionarily archaic brainstem that's having to negotiate a kind of working relationship with an evolutionarily very recent cerebral cortex. It's just like the most striking example of this. And the picture of the Badiou has of neuroscience, you'd think that neuroscientists believed the brain was this, very well integrated, harmonious machine where its different localities cooperate so as to generate, each locality on its own, a specific feature of who and what we are, and that this is, and that tracing these correlations is all that neuroscientists do. That does not at all reflect the fields that he is, I think, very unfairly comparing to 19th century phrenology.
Yeah, that's an excellent kind of defense of kind of your philosophical neuroscience, I think. So to finally turn to Quentin Mielisu, you bring up one of the core issues in his work in the form of a question: did the Earth exist before humans? You connect this to a set of epistemological and metaphysical questions. So can you unpack why is this even a sensible question to ask, and what is Mielisu's response to it?
Yes, and this is another place where I am very much in agreement with my interlocutors, that I'm quite sympathetic to what the gist of what Maeusu is after, you know, when he talks about, for instance, you know, the existence of the earth before humans. And to, you know, oversimplify somewhat, you know, one of the things that Maeusu is preoccupied with doing, particularly in his book After Finitude, is challenging a longstanding kind of dominant tendency in continental European philosophy that we can indeed, as Maeusu does, trace back to Kant. And that, you know, of course, starting with Kant, you have this line of orientation philosophically that says anything knowable or that can count as existing for us humans is dependent upon our subjectivity. That, you know, our subjectivity generates the field of our experience, and the objects that show up in that experience is what we are able to have knowledge about, etc. That these are, even if there are things in themselves apart from us, the scope of our knowledge is limited to how things show up as mediated by and dependent upon our own subjectivity. Maeusu, to condense a lot, you know, one of the things that Maeusu points out is that if you take someone who has this sort of sensibility and wants to say all knowledge, all reality even, or what counts as reality for us is dependent on us, is reliant upon our own subjectivity and how it mediates things, etc., however sophisticated the defense of this sort of idealism, starting with Kant, you can problematize this by pointing to some things that, are really going to result in some awkward responses from these sorts of subject-centric philosophers. And so, you know, Maeusu, you know, talks about, you know, the, you know, of course, the existence of the earth before humans, you know, and even more specifically brings up as an example, fossils and, you know, fossils, you know, long predating, you know, the rise of Homo sapiens and even of, you know, of sentient animals. And, you know, Maeusu pointing to these fossils, you know, says, okay, well, you know, our present best science, things like carbon dating, et cetera, you know, indicates the fossils are this age and hence long predate there being any sentient beings with conscious awareness, et cetera. Okay, idealists, you know, starting with Kant, how do you deal with this? And, you know, what Maeusu wants to say is that basically you get answers that are as awkward and implausible as, you know, for instance, how Christian creationists or fundamentalists, you know, deal with fossils, right? Where, you know, okay, here you have this fossil that's millions of years old, yet you have this biblical story about the age of the earth being much, you know, shorter than that. And the idea that, well, these fossils were planted here by God to test our faith. That, you know, what you get with, you know, various idealists who say, well, everything that, you know, we can know and that counts as reality for us is dependent on our subjectivity. Well, what about all of this material that especially the sciences have served up, which seems to involve us not only being aware of, but being able to know things about, you know, the earth and the universe that vastly predate, you know, by huge orders of magnitude. The relatively brief period of natural history in which you have sentient life on Earth, and in particular, you know, Homo sapiens around. Maeusu wants to point out that there's a way in which any kind of subject-centric idealism can't do satisfactory intellectual justice to what, you know, we have massive amounts of evidence for in the guise of what natural science tells us about, you know, the time frames of natural history and the place of life in general and of human life specifically within it.
Maeusu bases a lot of his thought on David Hume, although you argue that he has cherry-picked bits of Hume without always following through on the full implications of the elements he picks up. And the result is he ends up with various sort of inconsistencies in his ideas. So can you unpack kind of the fail to follow through and what he ends up with?
Yes. And so for what Maeusu relies on most in Hume's empiricist work is Hume's problem of induction, as it's called. And, you know, what Hume purports to show in his philosophical analysis of our concept of causality, you know, that we use to talk about any and every cause and effect relationship. Hume seeks to demonstrate is that we are never actually entitled to say that we a given pattern that we observe as involving for us cause and effect is an eternally necessary law that will always hold in all instances. So, you know, if you take any natural scientific law, you know, that we propose as an inviolable cause and effect structure that governs, you know, certain phenomena, that, you know, as Hume points out, that, you know, we human beings are never going to be able to test an infinite number of times in all times and all places to be able to test for the eternal validity of our hypotheses about causality. There's no a priori guarantee that we have that all future cases are going to conform to past observed cases. And no matter how many past observed cases we have only a finite number of them, however large, and we're never going to be able to say we can go from believing that it is highly probable that certain causal patterns will continue to be exhibited, you know, in future instances, to saying we are absolutely certain that we have, you know, a kind of maximal predictive power, which allows us to say that our knowledge about causality is absolutely certain to hold good indefinitely into the future. And so for Hume, what we can conclude is that we can never be sure that we have, you know, direct insight into mind-independent causal necessity. It might be there, but we can never know because, you know, the fact of our finitude makes it such that, you know, we're condemned to only have a finite number of past confirmations with no guarantee that the future will continue to conform to the past. And this is one way of in a nutshell, summarizing Hume's problem of induction vis-a-vis causality. And Maeseu's move, and it's, you know, sort of a Hegelian style one, is to take this Hume and, as I might describe it, to transubstantiate ignorance into insight. And what I mean by this is that Maeseu takes the problem of induction and says, whereas Hume wants to treat this as a matter of ignorance in terms of epistemology, right, and a theory of knowledge according to which we can't know whether what we take to be causal laws really are necessities in mind-independent reality. Maeseu says, instead of viewing the problem of induction as an epistemological matter, and in specifically as a matter of ignorance, instead, we should treat it as, and this is the bit of Hegelian judo here, we should treat it as insight into a real absence of causal necessity in nature and reality itself. That, you know, for Maeseu, Hume ends up discovering that there are no eternally valid causal laws governing with you know, guaranteed perpetual authority how reality functions. And that for Maeseu, right, this leads to his idea of hyperchaos, which is that, you know, at any moment, what we take to be, for instance, laws of nature could be temporarily or permanently suspended, and other causal patterns or, you know, regularities might come on the scene instead. And, you know, in my view, just to stick with this sort of Hegelian style transubstantiation of ignorance into insight, this alone creates a bunch of problems that either Maeseu does not address, or when he or some of them that he tries to address, I don't think he satisfactorily puts to rest. And I can use a straightforward example here. So if we look back at the early 20th century and what happens in physics, right, we have the transition from a Newtonian to a post-Newtonian physics, and that at the micro level of quantum mechanics and the macro level of the general theory of relativity, we have the break with Newton. And if we really accept Maeseu's use of Hume's problem of induction, then Maesu has no means for prohibiting someone from saying, well, what happened in the early 20th century is not that we got, you know, learned from certain anomalies and you know, were able to develop a superior set of natural scientific explanatory frameworks than Newton could, but that, you know, that at some point randomly, like let's say in the late 19th, early 20th century, nature itself spontaneously, given Maesu's idea of hyperchaos, arbitrarily went from being a Newtonian universe to being a post-Newtonian one. So instead of, oh, the Newtonian scientists were mistaken or overlooked or didn't have the ability to observe certain things, you know, we could easily, in Maesu's framework, tell a story according to which, for some unknown reason or just for no reason at all, really, nature at some point in time at the turn of the last century just spontaneously on its own shifted from being a Newtonian to a post-Newtonian universe rather than, you know, the previous science was mistaken and, you know, had a very incomplete picture. And so in my view, these sorts of things are kind of reductions to the absurd of his position. I mean, if you have a position that appeals to natural science, as Maesu's does, but then allows for these sorts of outlandish narratives to be defensible, like, the universe really did transition from being Newtonian to post-Newtonian and not our science got better. If you allow for things like that are disastrous for scientific thinking and for, you know, how we consider the history of the sciences, then you've created more problems than you solved.
Interestingly enough, another place Bedu and Mielisu fall short in your view is actually part of a larger trend you see in continental philosophy, which is a more friendly disposition towards religious and theological thought, which is obviously incompatible with your sort of strict materialism. At times, this is explicit, as in Bedu's book on St. Paul, but at other times, it can be in much more subtle ways, such as Mielisu's hyperchaos. So can you unpack the way in which religion, be it systematically theological or in the form of New Age mysticisms, is smuggling itself into continental philosophy that you see here?
Yes. And here, and in certain other places, I've kind of laid out this historical narrative in greater detail. But this takes us back actually to the very origins of continental philosophy itself. I mean, what we call continental philosophy really traces back to, you know, in particular, the German-speaking world of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And you have in that time and place, in that specific context, you have a number of different developments that involve, you know, not only the best known, namely German idealism, Kant, Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel, but also you have, you know, along with them, for instance, the German Romantics, and then also a faction of thinkers who are avowedly defenders of religion generally, and here Protestantism specifically, going on this counterattack against the secular Enlightenment in the European context. And you know, they often are referred to as Pietists. And so you've got these Pietists, these Romantics, and these idealists. And you know, it's this set of groupings that, where you really find the roots of what we have ever, you know, what we've come to call continental philosophy. You know, of course, you and I in our previous interview about my book, A New German Idealism, you know, talked about Hegel's very kind of, you know, complex, fraught relations with religion and all of the interpretive controversies about his relationship to religion and especially Protestantism. But, I mean, if you look at just Kant and, say, the later Schelling, or you look at the Pietist, anti-Enlightenment polemicist Jacobi, you know, if you look at a number of figures from this late 18th, early 19th century German-speaking context, you know, what you find is that religiosity, both you know, explicit and implicit, you know, has been intertwined with a lot of continental philosophy from its inception. You know, a nice kind of version of what I have in view here was already laid out by the great 20th century Hungarian Marxist Georg Lukács. A book of his from 1954, The Destruction of Reason, does, in my view, a very nice job of starting with figures like Jacobi and Schelling at certain moments, and tracing this line of religiosity, spiritualism, et cetera, as it runs from them through figures like, Kierkegaard, it's Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, on through Heidegger, et cetera. And so there's this long, tradition, as old as continental philosophy itself, of continental philosophy being either, covert or overt religiosity in a certain way. Along with this, I mean, one version of this that you see is that, for instance, permutations of negative theology are just writ large across much of the continental philosophical landscape. I mean, if you look at the 20th century, you find that you have this kind of basic negative theological template, which shows up in, pseudo-secular guys. Sometimes it's avowedly religious or tied to theological points of reference, but often not. But, when you talk about being, other, flesh, the real, in certain versions, difference, etc., basically you have this recurring template, which is that you've got X, whether it's being, other, etc. And X is something which we cannot conceptually get to grips with, that eludes the powers of language, thought, etc. Yet nonetheless, this black hole is, this center of gravity around which all we can do is orbit endlessly, repeatedly, talking about it and its ineffability, its elusiveness, etc. This is just warmed over negative theology repackaged in various terminological guises. And I certainly don't think that the task of thought can be reduced to us in a kind of trance-like meditative state with drool coming out the side of our mouths, doing nothing but repeating these terms like being, other, difference, etc. Certainly Badiou and Mayasu are not guilty of that. I wouldn't situate them in that lineage. But Badiou's concept of the event is often, as various critics have noted, seeming suspiciously close to the religious notion of the miraculous, or with Mayasu's, distribution of the features of the old god, some of which he assigns what he calls hyper-chaos, and then Mayasu even talks about, well, the old god doesn't exist, hasn't existed, but might, because of the hyper-chaotic nature of reality, come to exist in the future, that you have, these different theological aspects to Badiou's and Mayasu's thinking, on my assessment, of course, are part of what lead to them failing to develop, thoroughly atheistic materialisms that truly do manage to break with the residues of these past, spiritualist and theological orientations.
To wrap this up, most of this book has been more focused on philosophical theory, but in the background, your political commitments, particularly to Marxist-Leninist theory, or some qualified version of it, and your critical stance on late capitalism are always operating. To wrap things up, can you reconnect your criticisms of the philosophical systems we've been outlining? And to be more specific, in spite of the radical aspirations of some of these thinkers, Badiou in particular, you find their theories of subjectivity insufficient for grounding a radical politics. So can you summarize the political failures of these ontologies? And what will a materialist ontology of subjectivity need to do to ground the possibility for radical politics?
Yes, and here, Badiou, of the three figures covered in the book, Lacan, Badiou, and Mayasu, he's the key one. Lacan was deliberately hard to pin down about politics and it was very provocative and, said various things that, one is able to work with productively as a political theorist, but he himself, was not deeply engaged with what we might call politics in terms of his thinking. And there's not really any political theory in Mayassu's work to date. But of course, with Badiou, yes, the political dimension is a key component of his philosophical apparatus and is omnipresent throughout his work. And so, yes, he's the crucial point of reference here. And you know, the way that I can actually rather, you know, concisely summarize my differences with Badiou here. Now, obviously, with both of us, there is this joint commitment, this shared, as Badiou would put it, fidelity to the legacy of radical leftism, you know, including and especially the Marxist tradition, you know, and the sense that it is only within this part of the radical leftist tradition that you have articulated, you know, anything that can give us some at least qualified hope, you know, for a better future on the other side of capitalism, hopefully. But, you know, Badiou is led by his fundamental philosophical framework, by, you know, his systematic ontology and theory of subjectivity, to sideline three different dimensions, all of which are, by contrast with him, central to my own approach. So we've talked about how, you know, Badiou wants to marginalize, you know, the relevance of natural science and especially the life sciences, biology. He wants to, you know, view that as really just irrelevant to, you know, how we think and talk about who and what we are. And then, you know, in relation especially to the Marxist tradition and to Badiou's vision of politics, I mean, you might say that Badiou is a communist but not a Marxist in the sense that whereas for Marx, Engels, and most of their successors, there was a sense that both economics and politics as involving the state were central points of reference, and that, you know, both in terms of theory and practice, the economy and the state are two key domains of concern for traditional Marxism going back to the founders themselves. And, you know, Badiou, in his conception of politics, is insistent that we think of radical leftist politics now in a mode where we disregard both the economy and the state, and that, you know, politics is not in any kind of conditioned relationship vis-a-vis the economy. And this, of course, is at odds with what classical historical materialism indicates. And that moreover, that radical leftism should no longer be concerned with achieving state power, whether through peaceful or violent means, whether through, you know, through, you know, reforms and participation in the electoral process or, you know, revolutionary interventions like October 1917. And so he wants this conception of a kind of communist politics that that just disregards the dimensions of the economy and the state. And that for me, you know, especially if we're talking about Marxism, the most valuable elements of it are, first of all, Marx's philosophical anthropology, in which a life scientific approach to who and what we are is crucial to his theory of labor and labor's role in how we you know, construct and are part of our own social histories. And in addition, unlike Badiou, and here Zizek and I are in real agreement, that this you know, downplaying of the economy in the sense of the economy as, you know, as just separate from the, you know, the concerns of politics proper, totally disagree with that. I mean, I think that, you know, now more than ever, you know, the centrality of the economy to our entire, you know, socio-political existence is really just, you know, I don't see how one can credibly, you know, disregard that or not take it into account. You know, I think if anything, you know, our current circumstances really vindicate, you know, a lot of what was involved in Marx's emphasis on the central role of the economy, particularly in terms of capitalist socio-political dynamics. You know, and then also, you know, the notion of, you know, of a politics that, you know, just disregards the state as, you know, as a mere matter of administration, bureaucracy, you know, technocratic oversight, et cetera. You know, that too, I also, you know, thoroughly disagree with. And I think, you know, the issue of how you successfully institutionalize radical change, including through forms of governance that Badiou associates with the state in a disparaging manner, I think is also utterly crucial to any politics that would, you know, try to dramatically alter our circumstances. And so I don't think you can have, you know, anything that would count as truly revolutionary change without altering both the economy and the state. So yeah, those are, you know, those are, I think, big bones of contention, you know, between myself on the one hand and someone like Badiou on the other.
Well, that brings us to the end of volume one. So for any listeners still with us, we're planning on talking about volume two. I have a copy on my desk right here, so we'll get to that when we can. So in the meantime, Adrian Johnston, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you again for having me, and I very much look forward to our conversation about volume two whenever that happens.